This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, welcome to the new age of superfires. We talk with silviculturalist John Betts, who explains the strange, unstoppable forest fires rising up in the United States, Canada, Australia, and even Europe. Then we visit with one of the last great intact forests on Earth, the Canadian boreal. Loggers are chewing it up for paper, clothes, and even cellulose for your ice cream. Now talks between industry and environmentalists appear to be breaking down. Nicole Rycroft from Canopy explains. Top that off with Donald B. Luria, the medical doctor who says loss of faith in the future can kill. So think happy thoughts. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Are we entering the age of super forest fires? Our guest is John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association. He's in British Columbia, Canada, in the gorgeous lakeside town of Nelson, B.C. John, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Is there a potential for super fires in British Columbia?
Yeah, I think there is a potential, and to kind of answer your question, not to shorten the interview by any regards, but I think we've already entered the era of superfires both in Canada, continental U.S., Australia, and other areas as well.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, what we're beginning to see are fires of unusual intensity, severity, frequency, and so on, occurring in different forest types across the world. Again, I'm most familiar with what's occurring here in BC and in parts of the U.S., but certainly we're seeing the same tendency in Australia. The other thing that adds more severity to these and sort of brings with it a whiff of catastrophe is the fact that human habitat has been encroaching into these forest ecosystems, which are in a certain, we'll talk about a little later, but they're in a not a great state to begin with. And once you begin to embed human habitat like homes and so forth, as well as infrastructure like watersheds and transmission corridors, quite a lot of values are at stake. And so we're seeing loss of infrastructure and lives as well, and communities are being destroyed by wildfire on a scale we haven't seen before either.
Well, so what is new about these fires? We've had fire for centuries. What's new about these?
Well, I referred to intensity and severity. So those are, I don't want to dwell too much on the technicalities, but the intensity refers to the energy a fire releases, and severity is the duration, to put it simply, the damage it does in the duration of time it spends burning. What we're seeing, because of the available fuels, and this is a term I'm going to come back to this, because there's so much more wood on the landscape to burn, we're seeing fires burn, as I said, with more energetically, with longer durations, with increasing frequency, and also spreading at quite higher rates than we've typically seen. So fire behavior in many locales around the planet is changed significantly. Plus, these fires are beginning to take on a capacity to be destructive, not only to the communities that we have built in them, but they actually are starting to damage the ecosystems that they are part of themselves. They're actually doing long-term damage to the habitat. These fires are burning well out of the sort of normal range of variability that we might see.
Right. You told Justine Hunter of the Globe and Mail newspaper these fires can burn so hot they actually sterilize the ground. Does that mean nothing much grows back there for a while, or not a forest, or what?
That can occur, and it has to do with the structure of the fuels. In other words, just exactly what is catching fire. I think I need to step back a bit to explain just how that can occur. And I'll use BC as an example. We've had an outbreak here of the mountain pine beetle, which has affected approximately 15 million hectares, or close to about twice that in terms of acres. So 30 million acres of land has been either degraded or destroyed, meaning the standing trees are pretty much all dead, across a huge area of British Columbia. So what happens then is those trees stand for some time, maybe depending on the location and the weather and so forth, but within about 10 years, they start to break down. I mean, obviously, they dry out and desiccate, they crack and they check, the bark comes off, other little bugs and beetles get in there after the mountain pine beetle. It's a bit of a heyday maybe for woodpeckers for a while, but basically, the stand then begins to break down and fall into itself. It may lean up against other trees, or if they're alive, if it's a mixed stand, it may lean up against live trees, or they fall onto the ground and form a kind of a jackstraw matrix of fuel. Well, that area then, that creates, if you can picture that in your mind, when that catches on fire, and you've all built bonfires and so forth and figured out when you sort of stack your sticks in a certain way, you can get a really good fire going. Well, I'm oversimplifying some, but the gist of it is the fuel is across a large portion of the landscape here and in many other parts of continental U.S. and other parts. The fuel is now structured to burn quite differently than it would normal if it was a normal standing forest. So, and when that happens, the fires burn for a long time, and the heat is radiated down into the soil, and it's in that soil that all the little enzymes, bacteria, seeds, and so forth that under a normal healthy fire regime would simply re-sprout and come back actually get killed off.
Well, as you say, this isn't just a problem for British Columbia. People from Colorado all the way to Australia, even Spain, face the threat of superfires. John Betts, you were just at a fire meeting. Can you tell us what it was and some of the things that you heard there?
Well, our association, the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association, hosted a major international wildfire conference in Kelowna, British Columbia, just a few weeks back. And what we did was we brought speakers in, experts in the wide range of areas of interest around communities and wildfire. And we brought speakers from Australia, United States, Canada, British Columbia. And they spoke to a wide range of issues. Our purpose here was to make British Columbians aware, and particularly community leaders, to appreciate the problem that we're seeing grow on the landscape right now. I think there's still some simplistic thinking, which is forgivable given the weight of responsibilities that municipal and provincial governments have upon them. But the notion that we can deal with wildfire as we have done traditionally through suppression, and that's all we need to do about it. Well, of course, what we're seeing in these fires, and it's been certainly some of the people who are saying this loudest are the suppression people, is that these are fires that we really can't put out. So to rely on suppression as a way of protecting neighborhoods and all the infrastructure I just described, both community-related as well as industries that are embedded in the forest as well, we need to be thinking of different strategies to how we manage the land. To put it simply, we need to take the fuel out of the forest that's going to contribute to these catastrophic wildfires. And that was the purpose of the conference, was to expose people to all the various aspects of this. I mean, we covered everything from home insurance, like what effect are catastrophic wildfires having on the home insurers in the U.S., and will that travel up to Canada? Will those same effects be held here? We talked about what kind of buildings need to be built and what materials need to be used and what do you have to do around your own house or in your community and what needs to be done out on the landscape to mitigate the effects of these hazardous, these very dangerous wildfires. So we covered quite a lot of ground. We tracked over 200 individuals from across BC, Alberta, far away actually as Australia as well, who have an interest in this topic. So we think this kind of discussion needs to really happen, because the remedies are going to be found not just in protection and emergency response, but in what programs do we undertake to remove the fuels that are threatening communities? How do we pay for that? Is there value in the biomass that we're removing? Could that possibly be used to heat schools or create bioenergy fuels? What kind of creative responses do we need to that? And, a whole range of issues. We wanted to emphasize that to deal with wildfire threat, we need to take a holistic approach.
Right. Well, the old theory of forest management, and it was pushed by parks management and some greens as well, was just leave that fallen wood as part of the cycle of building forest soils. Your association does have an interest in changing that to remove more of the dead wood and the undergrowth. Is that right?
Yes. But it's interesting to remark that in the national forests in BC and Alberta have very active programs of managing for wildfire, which include removing trees. Heaven forbid, I'm not going to say the word logging in the parks. But they've realized that they have a huge problem there in terms of the fact that many of the landscapes there have been denied fire. I should go back and emphasize that one of the primary causes of this threat is the fact that we've been suppressing fire effectively for quite a few decades. And the outcome of that is that the forests have missed their normal cycles of fire. So now when we get fires, and there's no reason to believe we're not going to have them, they tend to burn, as I said, in with intensities and severities and frequencies we have not seen before. So rather than risk the parks going up in smoke in the worst way possible, they're doing a combination of things. In some cases, they're lighting fires to simply reintroduce fire into the landscape. In some cases, they're coming in and thinning trees out and removing excess vegetation with the idea of, in fact, opening up grazing land that was lost to some of the ungulates that live in the parks because the trees have encroached on them because of the fire suppression. So we're seeing some of the most cutting-edge approach actually coming from the national parks. So there's a difference between some woody biomass needed to replenish the soil and removing the fuels that are, in fact, capable of destroying the soils.
Well, the fire threat can be terrifying when it reaches towns or cities. Could you tell our listeners about some of the incidents that have happened in British Columbia?
Well, of course, our conference was done in a sense to, I was going to use the word celebrate, but I guess that's not the right word, to remember the 2003 fires in Kelowna. And that was a very significant event, maybe a turning point in our appreciation of wildfire, although I have sometimes reasons to doubt whether we've really learned everything we needed. But we lost a couple of hundred homes in that neighborhood. We lost others in other communities, Barriere, north of Kelowna. We've lost some in the East Kootenays. It was a very bad year that year. But it's well worth noting that in just the Okanagan alone, in fact, just last year, there was a fire in a small community across from Kelowna called Trepanier Creek, which nearly destroyed, well, it did destroy part of that community, a very fast-moving, wind-driven fire that had an effect, nearly took out a shopping plaza and a number of homes and so on. So, and it behaved very differently than what we've expected. So we continue to see fires of that kind of severity and potentially catastrophic on a regular basis. Of course, in Alberta, Slave Lake is a huge fire event that everyone, I think the 40% of that community was destroyed by fire, and they're still rebuilding that community today. And of course, down in Colorado, to draw attention back there, because there are some very strong parallels between Colorado and some of the forest types we have here. They had a dreadful year just last year in Colorado Springs and the Waldo Canyon fire and so forth, where we saw, again, hundreds of homes destroyed in what would look, most of us would think were suburbs. They didn't obviously seem to be really embedded in the forest to the extent that we might think of when we normally talk about, you know, communities that build into the forest. So we've got a history here. It goes back, I think, in 1998 in BC, we had our first big warning. There was a fire near Salmon Arm. And it, what it did is it spotted sparks some few kilometers down into the community. And that's another thing that we need to be well aware of. Your neighborhood may not be right up against the woods, but the thing that tends to destroy communities are the burning embers. And some of them, we know, have blown 3-4 kilometers, and I've heard unconfirmed reports that they might even sometimes carry twice that distance. So they're capable of starting fires just by spotting. And we've seen that in a kind of a quiet little fire a few years ago up in the north of BC called the Binta Lake Fire. And then as a cold front pushed through, a cold low front pushed through, which it turns out is very conducive to creating big wildfires, that fire moved 20 kilometers in one day. So if you put that into the fire shed that I live in here in Nelson, which is an east-west valley, which is the way the winds tend to blow, that's a pretty scary phenomenon to see happen. And frankly, where I live, we've got woods built up, or that I wouldn't say that's out of the range of possibility.
Yeah, I've seen video in California where the fire just races over the hill out of sight before you can snap your fingers practically, and no human's going to get in there in time to stop it. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm talking with John Betts from the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association in Canada. And John, when I visited some communities surrounded by these dead pine forests, the discussion quickly turns to metal roofs for the very reason that you just brought up. Those dropping embers can start a fire right in the town. Should we be cutting down trees for fire breaks around the towns and cities? That's a very hot debate right now.
Well, I pick my words carefully here. You may have to take some trees down, but it doesn't mean you have to denude the landscape. But let's go back to what you just said about the homes. Let's face it, in many cases, you look at the pictures, you'll often see the homes are burnt down, but the adjacent trees haven't. So the inference you can draw from that is that that home was more flammable and more prone to catching on fire than the actual adjacent trees. So I think the first thing you've got to do is make sure that you've got fireproof roofs. And metal roofs are one example, but there are all kinds of different materials that can be used. And in fact, going back to Colorado and the fires I mentioned in the Waldo Canyon, tens of thousands of roofs have been changed in those neighborhoods and are continuing to be changed. So you've got to make your house, to some extent, fire adapted. So you change the roof. You've got to clean your eaves out, too. Again, the eaves and valleys of your roof tend to accumulate materials. You can find out how to do all this through programs like in Canada, it's called Fire Smart Canada. In the United States, you can go to FireWise Communities or Fire Adapted Communities Coalition. Both of those programs are well known, and you can learn about what you can do to your own home. The community then needs to take some responsibility for what is the best thing to do around your neighborhood. Then that's where you got into sort of having to decide. You need to have fire experts come in. It isn't just, like I said, a question of cutting down every tree, but you're going to have to look at slope aspect, the previous fire history, the grasses. Remember that the other thing about cutting trees down is that within 4 or 5 years, things grow back up. So there's a kind of a long-term strategy. So it would be simplistic to say cutting trees down, but you need to actively manage the landscape around your community. And that could involve a number of things. Basically, what I'm saying here is that we can learn to live with fire if we design our communities in the right way and if we design our homes in the right way, and we also get active even further out on the landscape to modify, create fire fuel breaks, if you will, through how we log, how we harvest, and so forth, and begin to make it so the fire can actually pass through a neighborhood and we can simply, I'm oversimplifying a bit, but return to it and find that the neighborhood isn't destroyed, the trees aren't all gone, there's been a fast-moving fire that we knew was coming, got out of the way, are able to keep our homes from burning down and actually learn to live with every few years fire coming through if you're in an active fire management area. And of course, the frequency and return intervals would differ depending on the forest types and climate and so forth.
And I guess, too, some of it may be just really consider whether you want to go off and live in the woods. As you mentioned, some of the suburbs are expanding into areas and some people are building way back. Maybe your choice of where you're going to live could be important if the regime is changing.
Yeah, and now the insurance industry in the U.S., which hasn't really taken a whole lot of interest in wildfire compared to what they lose through tornadoes and hurricanes and other calamities, but they're starting to pay close attention to this, and that's one indicator that, just along the lines you said, Alex, that people are going to have to start thinking about when you move in, when you bring your flush toilet, if you will, out to the wilderness and park your home out there and start up your lawnmower. Remember, you're in a fire-based ecosystem, and you know, you have a right to live there, but you got a duty to sort of figure out what that means. And that may mean that you can't have the nice pine tree hanging over top of your porch or your roof. It may mean that you've got to think about whether that you're actually in a healthy forest and is there some things you can do to make it healthier. And that's a really important view to have. Because we've interrupted the natural cycles of disturbance, because we're experiencing we seem to have the symptoms of global warming at play, which is just sort of adding fuel to the fire, we need to be taking all of those things into consideration and learning also. We've introduced ourselves. We're well embedded in this. With that goes a responsibility to sort of live intelligently on the land, figure out whether your home is fire adapted. Don't be reliant on simply being bailed out by helicopters full of fire retardant. Take responsibility for your landscape and your expectations in that area.
Well, John, you raised global warming, and I know that you end up talking to mill owners and workers and loggers. Do they generally understand the role of global warming in the pine bark beetle, that the winters just are too warm and didn't kill them off, or do they still consider it some kind of green plot? What's your take on that?
I think people to be honest with you, I don't think global warming has actually played its hand yet. Yes, we've had a series of warm years where the beetle was allowed to survive in numbers we don't normally see, and that's an important factor. But I'm saying in a way that the landscape was about to sort of give out in some respect. Either it was going to be the mountain pine beetle or huge fires or something, because we had allowed the forest to depart so far from their normal regime. If you add global warming to this, and I think people understand that some people take the mountain pine beetle as a literal expression of global warming. I'm taking a more nuanced view, but what I'm saying is certainly the longer fire seasons, like we're adding 30 days to our fire seasons in parts of BC, clearly there's a trend going on here, and I don't think anyone's denying that. And in fact, I would say that the lumber logging industry has a very strong interest in fully understanding wildfire, global warming, and the effects it's going to have on their ability to simply harvest wood off this landscape.
Do you think we're going to be able to adapt our silviculture and maintain the ecology of forests and the business of forestry, even if we get, you know, these record high heats as they did in Australia, for example?
I'm afraid I'm being cast so many times as the sort of fatalistic prophet of doom, but let me switch channels briefly. We have still a window to do intelligent things on the landscape. There are moments when it seems the pace of events, the catastrophic events, seem to really be able to, as you've mentioned, that fire that went across the horizon before we could notice it. clearly, I think there are times when I wonder if we're going to keep up. But I think there are things that we can do, and we can start at our home. We can spread out through our communities. We can at least begin to make sure that our neighborhoods and watersheds, and I use the term fire shed, are protected. We can start with that. And I think out of that, I'm going to be optimistic, which is untypical, but I think we can actually generate an economy around reducing the hazard that currently we face in the forests and many of the parts of the world. And that we can take some of that biomass that I'm saying needs to be removed and convert it, as I said earlier, into the economy as to make products. Maybe that would then overcome the biggest obstacle here is how do you pay for all of this work that needs to be done to undo the consequences of how we've managed our forests to date. It's a huge debt, but there may be ways to do it. And I have to take the optimistic view, because as you mentioned in the outset, I do live in a very nice place on the shores of Kootenai Lake, and I have a vested interest personally in not going up in smoke. And I'm hoping that if we can get other communities and individuals and leaders, both at the state, federal, provincial levels, to take leadership on this, we can actually save the economy a lot of money. Because one of the consequences of fire is that you may hear sums of hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to suppress fire. But the long-term costs of fire are in many cases, as studies now show, 10, 20, 30 times that. If you blow out a major watershed to a major community, the consequences of that to rebuild that infrastructure artificially is huge. If you are beset with the degradation of the landscape so that you have floods and mudslides and so on, the cost of that, the health costs, the interruptions to the economy, the long-term consequences, which I don't even know how you put a measurement on, of having destroyed ecosystems, when you've actually burned an area off to the point where the only thing that can come in is opportunistic invasive plants. How do you put a cost on that? So there are huge costs that are associated with this, and I'm taking the view that I'm hoping that we can get out ahead of this. I'd say we've got 10, 15 years, and after that, I would not be so optimistic.
And I'm thinking most of these dead forests are going to burn, releasing more gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere. Do you think most of it will burn? And if you had to make a guess, when would the years of the giant forest fires come?
You know, if we go back to Yellowstone in 1988, I think that was 300,000 hectares. That was the equivalent of three times in one fire, three times what we would normally burn in all of British Columbia. And British Columbia could easily hold the state of Texas with a lot of room left over inside. So it gives you a sense of the size of it. We've already seen huge fires already. And it was interesting that certainly mountain pine beetle degraded forests were a factor in the Yellowstone fire. So if I'm saying that British Columbia and other large swathes of the landscape throughout continental U.S. and so on, at least in the coniferous forests, are subject to the same thing, it could happen as soon as 6 weeks or 2 months from now here in Canada when we enter sort of into the drying trend. If the jet stream sets up there and within 3 or 4 weeks, by just July or August, I hate to sound like this, but it's the truth, Alex, we are in a position to have terrifically huge wildfires after about 6 weeks of dry weather here in British Columbia and many other places.
I think it could come this year or next year, in the next several years. It more or less has to happen. That's just my opinion. You know, last spring I interviewed one of Canada's top fire experts, Dr. Michael Flanagan from the University of Alberta, and he told us that further north, the soil is so thin, it only takes 3 hot days to reach high fire risk, even after a period of heavy rains. 3 days, the forest can burn. How does that compare with your experience further south?
Yeah, you'd have to talk to fire behavior experts, but my understanding here is the lighter fuels do dry out very quickly. They can then carry fire quite well. So the larger fuels take a little longer to dry out, obviously. But the way things are configured here in BC, let's just say if we went through a cycle like we did a decade or so ago where we had about 4 or 5 years of relatively dry years. And then I think that, after El Nino and these sort of effects, the dryness tends to accumulate, and especially if you go back to that fuel matrix I described earlier where the wood is kind of stacked. In some cases, that wood isn't even covered in the snow. So, and no one's going to, we haven't really quantified this in any manner that I can understand, but it may, like I said, fire experts can perhaps help you with that question. But I'm saying that it doesn't take much to burn here, and it isn't the same fire type. But I mentioned the Trepanier fire in back in near Kelowna just last year. That fire moved very quickly on a very light fuel load that was largely pine needles underneath a closed canopy of lodgepole pine. with the wind and the dry needles, that was moved, produced a very dangerous fire that moved very quickly into a neighborhood. So we are seeing, as I said, fire behavior that we've never quite anticipated and are just beginning to try to figure out the models to predict. So we're straying into some unknown territory here, but the balance of probability is in favor of anyone that wants to say we're going to, as I have been saying, see increasingly large fires, increasingly frequent fires, increasingly intense and severe, and the catastrophic outcomes will be felt in many areas, economically, socially, and so forth, and they will be enduring. This is one of our largest challenges I think we face in British Columbia. Much is being said about the timber down shortfall and so forth. But, and there, in the past, we used to fight over things around parks versus clear cuts. This is a challenge of such complexity on such a scale that some of the old positions and the old thinking really isn't a match for it. And we're going to have to find new ways of approaching these problems.
We have been talking with John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association in British Columbia, Canada. You can find links to his organization and some of the stories we've been discussing in my show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Worldwide, less than 20% of our original forests remain intact. In 24 hours alone, 11 million trees are cut to make paper. Every day, we hold the very lungs of our earth in our hands.
Did you know the forests across the top of the world are being clear-cut on a massive scale? Will that affect your weather or your water supply? For 3 years, environment groups and the logging industry have been meeting, trying to preserve at least part of Canada's giant boreal forest. As far as I can tell, not a single acre or hectare has been protected by any law yet. The green group Canopy has had enough. They quit the talks and went back to campaigning. We have the executive director and founder of Canopy on the line, Nicole Rycroft. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be here.
Well, Nicole, before we dive in, for our worldwide audience, please tell us where the boreal forest is and why we should care what happens there.
Absolutely. The boreal forest actually is kind of like the green halo around the top of the planet. The area of forest that we've been really focused on is the section of the boreal forest that is across the north of Canada and into Alaska. It's one of the world's large remaining intact forest regions, basically the boreal forest in Russia, the Canadian boreal forest, and the Amazon are all that remains of the world's really large tracts of intact forest. And in Canada, we're really blessed with this incredible legacy of basically just thousands and thousands, millions of hectares of forests that are, you know, undisturbed by roads or power lines. And Canada's boreal is part of the world's largest terrestrial carbon sink. It stores the equivalent of 26 years of global fossil fuel emissions in the trees, the soil, the water, the peat. And it's also, for folks who are keen birders, it's the breeding ground for 30% of North America's bird populations. But birds come as far away as Australia and way down in the southern hemisphere to use Canada's boreal forest basically as its nursery every year. And then, as you mentioned in your introduction as well, the boreal forest is an incredible source of the world's fresh water, unfrozen fresh water.
So this boreal, it's also called the taiga, is that right?
It is. Taiga tends to be used more in Europe than in North America.
But we're talking about an issue that reaches right down to the northern U.S. states, even New England, certainly Scandinavia, right across Russia and Canada, as we're going to talk about. It's fair to say that the climate services of the boreal forest affect the whole world. Is that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we often refer to the boreal as our shield against climate change. And that every year with the logging that's continuing and very sort of extensive logging that's taking place in the boreal, both in Russia, in Scandinavia, as well as in Canada, that every year we're releasing massive amounts of carbon dioxide that have been stored for hundreds and thousands of years in the trees and the soil in the boreal and the taiga.
Well, this is something that puzzles me because I might think, and a lot of my listeners might think, well, look, we're taking this wood. We're going to, in a way, sequester the carbon in it into lumber or maybe even paper going into landfills or whatever. And then new growth is going to come up, and that will soak up some carbon. Maybe logging this boreal will help the climate.
Well, that's not a, I mean, it's not an unreasonable logic train to have. It's just incorrect, especially with the slow-growing forests that you have at both ends of the planet. And definitely the boreal is a slow-growing forest. And so unlike the tropical forests that are faster growth, it takes hundreds of years for significant kind of tree growth to take place in these northern climes. And what happens when a tree is actually logged, the machinery needs to roll in, and so there's a disturbance of the soil and the peat that the forests grow on, so that automatically releases a significant amount of carbon into the atmosphere. And then when a tree is actually cut, there's actually a chemical change that takes place. And so even though a tree does continue to store a certain amount of carbon, if it sort of continues its existence as a 2x4, as a door molding, or as paper that we read our morning papers on, but it's significantly less than the carbon that it stores when it's alive and standing in its natural system. So there is a significant and massive release of carbon.
Okay, now, who wants to log the Canadian boreal forest, and how far have these corporations penetrated already?
Well, a lot of companies want to log the Canadian boreal forest, and we signed back in 2010 an agreement with 21 forest companies at the time, and that encompassed, that group of 21 encompassed, I'd say, about two-thirds of the forest areas in the boreal that were being actively logged at the time. So we're probably looking at 20 to 30 large operators with a lot of smaller, kind of more regionally based operators, you know, potentially, you know, I would say literally hundreds of those kind of smaller community-based operators.
And can you give us a thumbnail description of your organization, Canopy? Who are you?
Sure. Canopy, we're a not-for-profit environmental organization, and we work to protect the world's forests, species, and climate. And we do that by harnessing the power of the marketplace. So we work with just over 700 of the forest industry's largest customers, companies like Sprint, Scholastic, large publishers, large printers, and help them to develop environmental policies that then help shift their suppliers, the companies that are actually logging on the ground in the forests, help those companies encourage those companies to actually shift their practices on the ground. And so we're probably best known as the organization behind the greening of the Harry Potter book series internationally, but we've also been a key driver behind three of the world's more innovative conservation initiatives.
And what now is the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement, or CBFA?
So the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement essentially was designed as a coming together of the environmental community and the logging industry, essentially to map out a new pathway forward for Canada's boreal forests. And it was founded on the agreement that large-scale protection was needed of Canada's boreal forest, and that was one of the fundamental pillars upon which the agreement was built, and that we also live in a world where paper and wood products are an integrated part of our society, but that we need to make sure that the wood and paper products that we do continue to use are actually really coming from truly sustainable practices. And so once we'd sort of decided how much needed to be protected and where that protection needed to take place, then there was a commitment to ensure that the operations that did continue were really, truly sustainable and world-class, and that that would then lead to a sustainable supply of leading eco-products in the marketplace.
But in the last couple of weeks, Canopy suddenly announced you were withdrawing from the talks, from the agreement. Why quit now?
Indeed we did, and obviously, as you can imagine, we entered into the agreement with high hopes. We were one of the lead negotiators. I personally was one of the lead negotiators, as was one of my colleagues here at Canopy. So organizationally, we were a key player behind the agreement coming into being. And we entered into it with the intention of it being a game changer. And we heralded it as such back in May of 2010. But, you know, we're 3 years in. There are zero results. Not a single hectare has been protected. Species are still at risk across Canada's boreal forest. And so, you know, for Canopy, we decided that it's time to do things that are more effective.
Well, industry claims they suspended logging on almost 29 million hectares of boreal forest within their allotted areas, and that included caribou habitat. That sounds pretty good, but is it real?
When we started the agreement and the negotiations that led up to the agreement being publicly launched, there were two, not tokens because they were actually significant, but there were two concessions of goodwill on both sides just to kind of show that we were actually really serious in moving forward. So the conservation groups, Canopy, along with two other organizations that worked very actively in the marketplace, we agreed to suspend any do not buy or do not invest campaigns against the companies that were signatories to the agreement. And in return, and partly as a tacit acknowledgement of the importance of large-scale protection of the boreal forest, the forest industry did agree to suspend their operations in almost half of the 72 million hectares that the agreement covers overall. Those areas have, you know, for the most part not been logged in, but the deferrals timed out. There was a time limit of 2 years on the deferrals, at which point we thought that we were going to actually have, because of the way that the agreement had been structured, we thought that there was going to be significant protected areas established, that we were going to have a lot of caribou action plans in place, and that at that point it would actually make sense to open up where the deferral, where logging was and wasn't allowed, given that we were going to have a lot of areas, additional areas, and potentially new areas that were permanently being protected and being put into long-term deferrals. And so at that juncture, at a two-year mark, it would make sense to kind of step back, have a look, and then sort of redecide on how to extend the scope of that do-not-log area. Unfortunately, at the two-year mark, we didn't have any hectares protected on the ground, and we didn't have any caribou action plans that had been formally enacted by government, and the industry still decided that, you know, the original areas that they said that they wouldn't log in were no longer viable for them to stay out of, and so they just chose another 28 million hectares. I'm sure some of it overlaps, but we're not exactly sure where that is or how ecologically valuable it is at this stage.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Nicole Rycroft, Executive Director of the environmental group Canopy. We are talking about where your paper comes from and the fate of the giant boreal forest. Nicole, I'm wondering, like big magazines, Newsweek, newspapers like the Christian Science Monitor stopped using paper. They went online with Kindle and these electronic readers. That's the big trend. What will Canopy do and what will the paper industry do if the conventional markets for paper dry up in this electronic age?
Well, I can speak on Canopy's behalf. We are definitely have seen in the last 5 to 10 years a dramatic shift to online consumption of information, be it the advent of Kindles to folks just kind of browsing on their laptops the daily newspaper. So in North America, we have seen a significant reduction in some grades of paper consumption, like newsprint. Overall, there's been a slight reduction in the amount of paper that's consumed, although home printers have definitely increased the amount of printing and writing grade paper that's used here. But what we're seeing globally is that there actually hasn't been that much of a reduction in paper consumption, and in fact, overall, the trend is that it's still continuing to increase. And what we're also seeing, and as you noted, there have been some significant titles that have shifted across, like Christian Science Monitor, to electronic formats. But what we're seeing is that as paper mills have closed across Canada and the U.S., that mills are being retrofitted to produce other products. So the pressure on our old-growth forests, both here in Canada as well as around the world, is not diminishing. In fact, it's increasing, even though paper consumption may be sort of on the drop in some regions.
And we can turn these forests, we can chew them up and turn them into clothing. Is that right?
We can turn them into clothing. We can turn them into what's known as biofuels. So they're often being either fed straight into a furnace or made into small pellets and sent to Europe and other markets for folks to put into their wood-burning stoves. They're also, you know, any food product that you eat that has cellulose, there's a good chance that that's coming from a forest. And it's also starting to be used increasingly in electronics. So there seems to be no shortage of places that these fragile and really vibrant ecosystems can actually end up in.
It's so strange to think of this. We're talking mainly about the far north where there aren't a lot of people. The landscape can be a little bit forbidding, so can the climate. And yet we're going to draw from that and sort of feed it into the whole social industrial machine.
Absolutely. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me that in 2013, we're still using 1,400-year-old trees, or in the case of the boreal, probably 300 or 400-year-old trees, to print Jackie Collins novels or to put into Haagen-Dazs ice cream. There is something that's really kind of illogical about that, that we haven't been able to work out other options that are more ecologically sustainable.
And we haven't talked enough about those who do live in the boreal. We've just learned from Alan Savory that wild herds have a huge role in capturing carbon back into the soil. How are the caribou herds doing, and what needs to happen to keep them alive and healthy?
So woodland caribou are threatened and endangered across their entire range across Canada. And that's because of they're a very shy animal. They're very sensitive to any disruption of their range or their habitat. And so any kind of mapping of historical caribou range basically shows that as people and as land clearing has taken place and forest fragmentation has taken place, the caribou have moved further and further north. And so this really is a species, the woodland caribou are a species that are on the brink. They need big open spaces that don't have roads in them and that haven't been fragmented. And that was one of the things that we were hoping that the Boreal Forest Agreement would actually help us deliver, that it would protect 50 to 70% of the boreal forest and that it would help ensure the health and proper forest management of for the long-term well-being of species like woodland caribou. But at this stage, it doesn't look as though that agreement is going to actually deliver on that.
And no doubt the First Nations or Aboriginal people of Canada welcome some logging jobs instead of poverty. Nicole Rycroft, do the First Nations generally support boreal logging, or do some oppose it? What's happening there?
It's almost impossible to give a sort of a generic answer to that. Obviously, different communities have different social needs and aspirations and different visions of how they can help support the social well-being of their people and of their communities. But across the board, what we find with the First Nations communities that we work with is that there's a very strong connection to their traditional territories and to the trap lines that have historically been such an important part, and in many cases continue to be a really important part of not only the cultural heritage of the community, but also the physical sustenance and the economic well-being of the community. And so across the board, I haven't met any First Nations leaders or community members who have been happy about large-scale industrial development and destruction of their lands.
Okay, well now we did see a fairly successful agreement for the Great Bear Rainforest in British Columbia. It's still a bit disputed. We'll see how it goes. But, you know, Greenpeace has withdrawn from this boreal agreement as well, Greenpeace Canada. How will if it fails, how would that cool the whole idea of negotiating directly with polluters and resource companies instead of the public activism environmentalists are known for? What are your thoughts on that, Nicole?
Well, I think it is an issue of making sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, that Canopy has also been involved in the Great Bear Rainforest Agreement, as has Greenpeace. It isn't complete yet, but it is definitely further down the track than the results to date have shown in the boreal. 50% of the Great Bear Rainforest is either under formal protection or a level of conservation. And hopefully they are tracking towards delivering that last 20% of conservation that all parties have agreed to historically. So when that happens, which will hopefully be by September of this year, that will mean that 70% of the old-growth forests of the Great Barrier Rainforest are being conserved. And there's obviously been some innovative work and economic diversification work done with local communities, and First Nations government are in an equal decision-making sort of relationship with the provincial government. That's definitely a model that Canopy has actively been involved in, thinks that there is a lot of value in, and actually tried to sort of seed across into the Boreal Forest Agreement. But, you know, sometimes big ideas don't pan out quite the way that you envision them or that you hope that they will. And so that's when you need to, you know, you do all that you can to try and course correct. And if you can't course correct, then there's no point in lending, continuing to lend your time and your energy as well as your reputational capital to a talk and log process.
What's up for Canopy now? What are your priorities?
So we will be redirecting our energy to ensure that we can deliver conservation results that are proportional to the scale of the environmental problems that we're grappling with globally. So we'll be reinvigorating our collaborative work with the 700-plus customers of the forest industry that we work with, and we'll be looking to develop new strategic alliances with logging companies who are actually really committed to producing meaningful results on the ground. And when we do produce meaningful results on the ground, so large-scale protection and action plans for species health, then we'll make sure that those results are rewarded and recognized in the marketplace.
And I've heard about an area in Quebec. Is it the Broadback? Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The Broadback Valley is one of the boreal gems, and there is broad stakeholder support for an area that's, let's see if I've got the numbers right, 3.2 million acres, which is about 13,000 square kilometers of this beautiful, very carbon-rich boreal forest valley to be protected. So the Cree First Nations have put forward a proposal that would see this massive area, which represents about 62-65% of that region, actually being formally protected and conserved. And there's obviously Canopy and a number of other environmental organizations are in support of that. We have a number of large customers in the marketplace who are also supportive, and a number of the large tenure holders have agreed to suspend their operations in the area with the hope that the Quebec government will take that final step and formally protect it. So we're hoping for a positive announcement in that area sometime very soon, actually.
Right. I saw a photo of it on your website and immediately fell in love. What is your website, and how can people find you on Facebook as well?
So our website is canopyplanet.org, and you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/canopyplanet.
Okay, if anybody missed those links, you can find them in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. We have been speaking with Nicole Rycroft, founder and executive director of Canopy. Nicole, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot, Alex. I really enjoyed our talk.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. If we lose faith in our future, can that help bring about the catastrophe we fear? One speaker at the March 2013 conference on Fukushima in New York caught my attention with his off-topic introduction. Donald B. Luria is a medical MD and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He asked, "Are we losing our faith in the future? If we do, what are the likely consequences?" Luria was leading into his studies on the impacts of pessimism and his book titled Rethink, A 21st Century Approach to Preventing Societal Catastrophes. First, I'm going to play you 4 minutes from his comments at the symposium, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident. But he's talking about a lot more than that.
I've devoted myself to systems. Nuclear power is part of the energy system. And for a few moments, I'd like to focus on a broader context. If this conference makes the judgment that nuclear power should be restricted and then abandoned. It has, of course, huge implications for the energy mix that we use. It does more than that, though. It emphasizes, in my judgment, three interrelated questions. One relates to the mix that we are going to use for energy. And more directly, it raises the question as to why the United States and other nations have not developed a veritable Marshall Plan for the acquisition of alternative environmentally friendly energy sources. That we have not is an absolute disgrace. The second question is, if we move vigorously, when is it realistic to expect that we will have enough abundant alternative energy sources that we can profoundly reduce the use of fossil fuels? And related to that, since any realistic projection, even if we do move vigorously, indicates that it's going to be quite some time, what are we going to be using for our energy mix in the intervening years? Now, these three interrelated questions lead me to what I think is the most important, most critical single question and issue, and that is the following. At the rate we are going, in the absence of very vigorous action, when, that is, what year, do we reach the tipping point beyond which the damage we're doing to the environment, global climate change consequences, are so severe that societal devastation and catastrophe is virtually inevitable? I believe that in the coming years, that is going to be the centerpiece of the debate. And why shouldn't it be? After all, what's at stake is the very survival of our society, at least a society as we know it now. Because I am interested in systems, a few weeks ago, I put together two systems diagrams related to the tipping point. One is pessimistic, the other optimistic. The pessimistic one assumes that we will continue with business as usual, that whatever actions we take are going to be inadequate, and that we do not manage successfully the critical determinants related to the tipping point, such as population size and population growth, CO2 emissions, control of methane sources, among others. And that these important factors, these determinants, then converging, the ones I mentioned plus others, will result in a tipping point with societal devastation. The optimistic scenario is just the opposite, that we will act vigorously, we will control and manage the determinants, and we will avoid the tipping point. Now, one other aspect that I think is worth mentioning. If people in our society, especially young people, get to believe that the pessimistic scenario is the more likely, that a tipping point will occur, that perception will likely result in loss of faith in the future. And that loss of faith in the future among people in the society has dire consequences for individuals and for the society, and is in point of fact virtually independent of whether the tipping point actually occurs. All that's needed is the perception that it will occur.
That was Dr. Donald B. Loria. I think he raises a deep problem for us all. To fill out his comments, I'm just going to read directly from Loria's explanation of his book, Rethink, as published online in September 2010. Quote, in 2005 and in 2007, I and my colleagues carried out national studies to assess the perceptions of people about their own future, the future of their country, and the future of the world. The respondents were divided into four age groups, 18 to 24 years, 25 to 44 years, 45 to 64 years, and over 65. In every age group, more than 80% were optimistic about their own future, but in every age group, the majority were pessimistic about the future of the United States and the world. Importantly, the majority in each of the four age groupings believed we are not able to solve or significantly mitigate the major problems facing us, such as terrorism, global warming, the potential for nuclear or biological warfare. These studies strongly suggested that Americans of all ages are well on their way to losing faith in the future. Since our last survey, more than 2 years ago, a number of events have occurred that almost certainly will accelerate that loss of confidence in the future, reduce optimism about one's own future, and increase the pessimism about the future of the United States and the world. There has been a severe recession, and with it, a terrible toll in lost jobs and diminished confidence. There is increasing distrust of Congress that seems unable to deal effectively with our most serious problems. The countries of the world, including the United States, appear unwilling to take the necessary actions to avoid catastrophic consequences of global climate change. We are told that unless healthcare costs are contained, our healthcare system will eventually bankrupt the country. Yet despite an extended and acrimonious debate, there is nothing to suggest our government has figured out a way to cope with or prevent this looming disaster. I fear we are now in great danger of a large percentage of the public having their hopes for the future battered, being overwhelmed by feelings of hopelessness in regard to our ability to cope with the major problems facing society. If that occurs, there are substantial societal and individual consequences. There will be a dramatic increase in the frequency and severity of anxiety and depression. There will be a much greater focus on hedonism, with increased risk-taking and pleasure-seeking, including the use of mind-altering drugs, both legal and illegal, alcohol included. There will be little attention paid to preventing or mitigating future problems and threats. Politicians, even more than now, will focus almost entirely on present issues, thereby making the future even more bleak. The depression epidemic will have physical and other consequences, with increased incidence of suicide and heart attacks, marital discord, inability to function effectively, and overeating, a well-known response to depression, that will exacerbate our obesity and diabetes epidemics. Make no mistake about it, loss of faith in the future is a very serious business. If widespread enough, it is society-threatening. There is, in my judgment, only one preventative. People, especially young adults, must be convinced that we as a society are still meliorist, that is, able to solve the major problems facing us by the dint of our own efforts. That, in turn, means our politicians and leaders must give the perception they are approaching major issues in potentially effective fashion. To do so, they must know when to use and how to use what I have called societally connected systems thinking. That is why I wrote the book Rethink, A 21st Century Approach to Preventing Societal Catastrophes. Now, the questions for me are, will my recommendations about how to approach major societal issues be implemented by educational institutions and the political establishment? Will the book be read by sufficient numbers of people to give societally connected systems thinking a chance? Will anyone even care? And that was a reading from Donald B. Loria talking about his new book. In my opinion, the book Rethink, A 21st Century Approach to Preventing Societal Catastrophes, looks a little academic for most of us. The ideas in it need to be popularized somehow. It's almost idealistic to think there is a social body, even government, that rationally analyzes our direction towards the future instead of taking bribes and takes action to avoid catastrophic futures. But that is just the negative thinking Luria is talking about. There have been some successes, haven't there? For example, we did manage to remove absolutely harmful substances from the food supply for a while, although that is lapsing. Humans in developed countries have set up a medical system. It's not available to all in the United States, of course. The Western nations managed to defeat the most evil regime that emerged in Europe in Nazi Germany. The Soviet Union and the United States managed to avoid an all-out nuclear war. But so far, there is no sign we are doing anything about climate change except making it worse, or about overpopulation, or the unjust distribution of wealth, all of which can have fatal consequences. Recent news articles and studies show Americans and Brits are indeed turning to more and more psychiatric and illegal drugs. Suicides are still ongoing. Stress levels are very high. According to the signs listed by Loria, we are already engaged in loss of the future. As we heard, this in itself could determine our future, whether the expected disaster arrives sooner, later, or never. On the other hand, how can we change our direction if we don't know our current situation or the possible futures? Thinking happy thoughts and leading disconnected lives isn't going to do it. Let me know what you think. Write me, Alex Smith. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. radio@ecoshock.org. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook.com/Radio EcoShock. Our Twitter feed is @EcoShock. Please support Radio EcoShock by visiting our website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith saying join us next week as we thrash through the big questions and the small answers. This is CyberZen Sound Engine.